Abington Health supports WHYY. Abington Memorial Hospital has been recognized as a fully accredited chest pain center by the Society of Cardiovascular Patient Care. The specialized physicians at their Heart and Vascular Institute help patients who arrive with symptoms of a heart attack, quickly evaluating patients experiencing these symptoms and offering the best available treatment options. If you have chest pain, their team is dedicated to helping you continue to enjoy life. Learn more at abingtonhealth.org.
If you give me the privilege to be your president, I will wake up every day, not only with my heart strong and my mind sharp, but with my ears open and my arms open to welcome the American people, no matter what party, no matter what race or creed or color, to make sure that you know that this is your country too. We are going to go and win this election, and I love each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
Christie announced his bid for the White House this morning at his alma mater, Livingston High School. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. On hand there to feel the love, and joining me now is longtime Christie watcher and WNYC reporter Matt Katz. Thanks for joining us again, Matt.
You got it, Dave.
Well, apparently Christie's not hiding from his outsized personality. I suppose it's both his strength and his vulnerability.
Oh, absolutely. What comes out of his mouth is the reason why he exploded in 2010, shortly after he became governor and became this national political personality. He would say things at town hall meetings and at press conferences that were just so unusual for a politician in this country that he became a YouTube sensation. And that's really the reason why, by the end of his first year in office in 2010, people were asking him, hey, when are you going to run for president? But, you know, his mouth does get him in trouble. He told somebody who had volunteered at the shore after Sandy for a month, who had concerns about the slow pace of recovery, to sit down and shut up.
And Christie said, you're going to get what I think, whether it makes you cringe every once in a while or not. But as you referred to YouTube, if you put together a compendium of those cringeworthy moments, it makes for a whole lot of ouch.
That's right. And, you know, we haven't seen that yet from, like, other Republicans in the field in terms of putting that together, because it's too early and because, frankly, Christie is not yet a major contender in this thing. He's too far down in the polls. But if he starts nipping at the heels of Jeb Bush and Scott Walker of Wisconsin, you're going to see those YouTube moments put together by the candidates or their PACs, and you're going to hear them talking about the fact that maybe Christie doesn't have the self-control to be president. He has a very difficult road to hoe in terms of looking at New Jersey's record and saying what he accomplished. His point, and he made this point today in his speech, is that the state was in such an economic mess when he got here that he has made progress and that there are more jobs than there were before, and that he hasn't raised essentially income taxes, really, and he's vetoed income taxes. So people aren't paying more income taxes and there are more jobs, and therefore it's a success. But property taxes continue to climb, and there's the Sandy recovery. And then there's also Atlantic City. I mean, four casinos have closed on his watch. He made a big deal about injecting state tax breaks into the Revel Casino, and we know exactly what happened there. It's now a vacant glass shell on the Jersey Shore, a symbol that his opponents could use of his failures at governance.
And given that, what is his path to, if only, nip at the heels of the front runners, let alone emerge from the growing field of what, now 14 contenders?
He's counting on using his political charms. I mean, he can tell stories at town hall meetings where he talks about his mother's dying words to him on her deathbed, and, you know, grown men cry. He can connect with people. He comes across, relative to a lot of other politicians, as a normal dude, and that's what he thinks people want. And he's going to try to exploit that personality as much as possible in New Hampshire, where they like iconoclasts, and they like supposed straight talk, and they like town hall meetings. And Christie's specialty is his town hall meetings. That's why he's having three in the next 2 days.
And is that part of his specific calculus, focusing on New Hampshire at the expense of other early primary and caucus states, Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada?
Yeah, absolutely. He's got to win New Hampshire. That's the plan. And then after if he can do that, then he can move on to the other states. His calculus is that if he does that, he then becomes the choice of the establishment. That if, let's say, they've war-gamed this out, as they say. So they've looked at the at the field, and they see Iowa going to a religious conservative, and then the next race is in New Hampshire, and he can devote all this time there. If he can win that, he gets to say to the establishment Republicans and to the people that fund these things, the billionaire Republicans, hey, where's Jeb Bush? Where's Scott Walker? Look at me. Maybe it's time to give me a second look.
Matt, thanks for joining us to shed light on Newsworks tonight.
Got it, Dave. Thanks a lot.
WNYC reporter Matt Katz.
Give me some straight talk, and a hold of sugar, please. Straight talk, sounds plenty sweet to me.
Now, some 7 months after Pope Francis officially announced he'd come to Philadelphia this fall, details of his trip are being confirmed by the Vatican, as WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
Pope Francis will be in town for less than 48 hours, and the schedule is jam-packed. Auxiliary Bishop John McIntyre says shortly after the pontiff's plane touches down, he will be whisked to the Cathedral of Saints Peter and Paul for what is expected to be the hottest ticket in town, an invite-only mass.
Our cathedral, with the use of our side chapel, the Chapel of Our Lady of the Blessed Sacrament, will hold approximately 1,600 people. So we have to miraculously divvy up the cathedral between all the people who make up the Archdiocese of Philadelphia so that the entire church is represented at that mass.
Next, the Pope heads to Independence Hall for a speech on religious liberty and immigration. Donna Farrell of the World Meeting of Families says it will not be a political speech.
For the Pope, it's about the pastoral, not the political. And for many of us, we might take that as a political statement, and certainly the Pope is not afraid to make strong statements. This is about those who are marginalized, those who may find their way more difficult in our country.
For 90 minutes on Saturday night, the Pope will come to the Ben Franklin Parkway to attend the Festival of Families, part of the World Meeting. The Pope will address seminarians Saturday and the cardinals and bishops on Sunday at St. Charles Borromeo Seminary in Wynwood, then travel to Kern Fromhold Prison in northeast Philadelphia. Prison Commissioner Louis Giorla says Pope Francis will probably talk to inmates in one of the gyms.
We're hoping that he brings something to Kern Fromhold, and we hope that there's a message of hope for the individuals who are incarcerated here, and a message of encouragement and professional support for our staff.
The biggest event of the week will be the Mass on the Parkway Sunday afternoon at 4, which is expected to draw a crowd of up to 2 million of the faithful. Church officials say although some of the events will require tickets, there is no admission fee for any of the events. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
On their final U.S. tour stop, members of the Jerusalem Youth Choir are in Philadelphia this week to share more than just their music, as WHYY's Nima Mershania notes after meeting up with them.
The Jerusalem Youth Chorus teamed up with the Keystone State Boy Choir and the Pennsylvania Girl Choir to put on a sold-out show Sunday night at the Kimmel Center. It's clear the three groups admire each other for their musical prowess, but a larger lesson was in the works for the two Philadelphia-based groups. The Jerusalem Chorus, which is made up of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim teenagers, both Israeli and Palestinian, pairs each of its rehearsals with dialogue exercises to help the teens talk about prejudices, social issues, and conflict in the Middle East. Micah Hendler, the group's founder and director, says music holds everyone together during those tough conversations.
Really, the music creates the safe space and feeling of community and feeling of working together for something, that we're all on the same team, that then you can challenge and be real with each other and really get at some hard issues, and people cry, people scream, people walk out of the room. But it's within the context of, but at the end of the day, we're all going to come back together and be friends because we have this concert or we have this recording.
One of the singers, Yara Mokari, says starting and ending each rehearsal with music is refuge for the teens who confront conflict daily.
So it's like after having a hard dialogue and communicating and trying to say what we want, but not hurting each other, and it's so complicated. Singing is like it's an escape.
The Jerusalem Youth Chorus spent an evening with the two Philadelphia groups teaching them how to apply their dialogue exercises to race issues in the United States. In the basement of a church in Chestnut Hill, the three choruses huddled in groups to talk about everything from the recent shooting in Charleston to the use of slurs in everyday conversation. Eva Whitaker of the Pennsylvania Girl Choir says what she learned will definitely apply to her life.
Trying to take the way that they look at their social issues and like get that perspective from them and put it into our own issues and try to see how we can become better problem solvers and be better community members and just try to do our best to solve these problems and be the most open, flexible people we can.
Indira Joel of the Pennsylvania Girl Choir says despite the language barrier and cultural differences, the groups quickly bonded.
Just having those moments with them that was like, everybody drop everything, we're going to dance, we're going to sing, you know, and really getting into the moment with them was just, that was incredible. So much fun.
Mordecai from the Jerusalem Chorus couldn't agree more.
The music is mostly the thing that holds us together. If we won't have music, we'll probably be enemies and we won't talk. Because if we don't have like a bigger thing that holds us together, we can't communicate.
For WHYY, I'm Nima Roshania.
Turning to this evening's headlines, on the eve of the new fiscal year, Pennsylvania is bracing for a late budget as Governor Tom Wolf has pledged to jettison a GOP-crafted spending plan. The proposal will likely arrive on his desk later this evening. A stalemate lasting more than 1 month could be bad news for school districts and counties with low cash reserves, though a delayed state budget would not stop Commonwealth employees from being paid due to a 2009 court ruling. The state would also have authority to pay for critical functions like state prison meals and human services. The Delaware Art Museum has sold two more paintings to retire its construction debt and replenish its cash supply. Museum officials announced today that Andrew Wyeth's painting, Arthur Cleveland, and Winslow Homer's Milking Time were sold privately. 75 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Periods of rain likely this evening, overnight, perhaps into tomorrow morning. Tonight's low 68 degrees. Then turning partly sunny Wednesday, humid high 86. Thursday, a mix of sun and clouds with a 40% chance of showers, high in the mid-80s. Friday, partly sunny, still a chance of rain, high 82. And for the 4th of July, partly sunny, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, Saturday's high 82. Still ahead, we'll hear from a Pennsylvania lawmaker who wants to outlaw discrimination against gays and transsexuals. And a gay rights activist remembers launching the movement in a more hostile time.
If we came out at that time, we could lose our jobs, we could lose our families, we could lose our apartments, we could be instantly homeless.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists introduces the new Watchman device, a minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Hoping to ride the momentum following Friday's historic U.S. Supreme Court decision paving the way for gay marriages nationwide, State Senator Larry Farnese is renewing his efforts to end legal discrimination of Pennsylvania's LGBT residents, and he joins us now in conversation. Senator Farnese, thanks for being here this evening.
Thank you for having me.
This is not the first time you've brought this type of legislation to the fore. Why do you think it has a better chance of succeeding this time?
Well, before I even get to the Supreme Court case of last Friday, I do note that last session, both myself and Senator Brown prime co-sponsored the bill, Senator Brown from the Republican side, and we had, I believe, 23 or 24 co-sponsors. So there were only 23 Senate Democrats. So clearly we had a bipartisan support, and we were very close to getting the bill out of the Senate last session. So with the momentum that has just been building with the Supreme Court case, quite frankly, I was hopeful even before the Supreme Court case came down because, you know, a recent study shows that 75% of Pennsylvania voters support updating our discrimination laws to protect gay and transgender people from discrimination. So I think it's right in line with what people around the Commonwealth and around the country want.
So let's focus on the specifics. Is this bill different than previous versions that you've submitted?
There's going to be some language changes, but I think when we get a final product introduced, the sole purpose is going to be what it has always been, and that is to stop what I and many people consider to be, you know, a just disgrace right now, where an individual can be turned down for a job, for example, solely because they are gay, and we have to stop that. What we will be dealing with the anti-discrimination bill is it's going to include as a protected class a sexual orientation and gender identity or expression, and that will be added to the list of protected classes. So this is basically updating our statewide anti-discrimination bill.
Is this focused primarily or exclusively on employment, or does it also consider other aspects, for example, housing?
Absolutely. Yes, it does, without a doubt. Right across the board, housing, employment, you know, renting, anything like that, it would be protected. For instance, we have people that come here that are some of the best and brightest that we have to offer in the country. They come to Pennsylvania and they want to have a job, they get hired, and then they find out, if you can believe this, that they are denied housing or a mortgage because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Now, what usually happens first is that people look at you and they say, you're crazy. That's impossible. It's 2015. Well, I'm not crazy, but it is 2015, and yes, we do allow legalized discrimination. And so right there, you know, to deny someone housing or a mortgage because of, to put it simply, who they choose to love, I think is ridiculous. And I think it's something that we must change, and I think we will be doing that, hopefully, you know, before this legislative session ends.
As you make this argument, though, for equal rights, why do you come up against so much intransigence among your fellow lawmakers?
I don't think the opposition is as much in my own chamber as it is with some individuals in the other. But 75% of the people in Pennsylvania want this. Other states around the country have it already. Surrounding states around us have it already. So Pennsylvania is a conservative state, but I believe that people in Pennsylvania, wherever you live, they are beginning to recognize that LGBT equality, whether it be same-sex marriage, whether it be equality in housing and employment, it's not a hot issue anymore. People understand it better, and they understand that we need to get with the rest of this country and with the rest of the surrounding states, and we need to provide equality. I mean, let's face it, you can't have equality for all when you still allow inequality for some. I mean, isn't that really what this is about?
If these measures make it to Governor Wolf's desk, is there any ambiguity in your mind about how he feels about it?
The governor has said that that is one of his priorities. He wants an anti-discrimination bill, and he campaigned on it. And so I am sure that, you know, he will be smiling ear to ear when he signs it, and you can bet your bottom dollar I'm going to be right there next to him.
Senator, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your interest in this.
Pennsylvania State Senator Larry Farnese on NewsWorks tonight. In contrast to his legislative effort and last week's Supreme Court ruling upholding same-sex marriage, the beginnings of the gay rights movement were fraught with hostility and danger. This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the first gay rights demonstrations outside of Independence Hall in Philadelphia. This week, a series of events are scheduled to celebrate the occasion. Those first protests were quiet events, even polite, but they were still fraught with danger. Marge McCann was a gay activist at the time, but was too afraid to picket openly. She tells us what was happening on the 4th of July, 1965.
A standard Philadelphia 4th of July day. Some are with her, some are wear dresses and coats and ties. And, you know, they gathered and they handed out the signs and they commenced to walk in a circle. It's not really very much more complicated than that. Protester hoping that the press would come, and me praying that they didn't. There was definitely something between me and the protesters, whether it was a tree or a phone pole, I don't remember. And I was in a relationship with someone at that time, and she didn't come to watch. Obviously, people stopped to watch, but not staying too long, because you didn't want to be too close, because if you were interested, you might be gay. If people expressed any support at that time, other people assumed that they had a secret that they were hiding. Although I was active in the gay rights movement in that time, through letters and speeches and things like that, nothing in Philadelphia. No openness. So this was a public event. This was something that, although the press did not cover the first year they could have, I was not willing to put my job and my family at risk, frankly. Because in the 1960s, we were continually being told we were mentally ill. Some of us believed it, some of us didn't. If we came out at that time, we could lose our jobs, we could lose our families, we could lose our apartments, we could be instantly homeless. It was not a good plan. And those few who were able to do it and or foolhardy enough to do it, we kind of admired them and feared them at the same time. There were strong divisions between those who were trying to assimilate, be invisible but free, and those who wanted to change the way society looked at us. There was a lot of discussion in letters and in underground newspapers about whether we should be wearing skirts, frankly. These demonstrations combined those two elements because they were out there asking for rights, but they were wearing skirts and the men were wearing ties and everyone was being extremely acceptable, conformist, if you will. Here we are, just like everybody else. Why won't you let us have a job? Within lesbian society, at least, I had people say to me in the bars, don't do that. They think everybody who's gay looks like a diesel dyke. If you let them learn that we look like just like everybody else, I'm in danger. Somebody might pick me out now where they never would have thought I was gay before. Those of us who were working on various issues were forming organizations and discussing among ourselves, but we weren't public. We were meeting and we thought of ourselves as a movement, but we were not yet public. These people were being public.
Marge McCann is a lesbian activist now living in Kennett Square. She remembered what it meant to be an activist 50 years ago. And ahead this week, we'll have more stories of those who took part in those early marches. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman for the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. With the opening of our new seven-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, Wistar Science is able to accelerate its efforts to create cancer treatment vaccines. These unique vaccines can help unleash the power of the body's immune system to kill cancer cells. Learn more about this and other advances in cancer research at wistar.org. Wistar Science saves lives.